Listen, the proof is right there in the pudding. Some of your favorite stars have used Backstage to kickstart their career. Denzel Washington, Sandra Bullock, Chris Evans, that's Captain America. You too can be just like Captain America. All you have to do is subscribe to Backstage. And you know what? You can do that right now for free. Here's what you gotta do. Go to backstage.com/subscribe and enter the code ENVELOPE at checkout for a 30-day free trial. That's 30 days of access to thousands of casting notices uploaded daily. You're just one click away from following the footsteps of some huge names that used Backstage at the start of their careers. Viola Davis, Scarlett Johansson, Al Pacino. As always, be like Al Pacino. Subscribe to Backstage today, and again, use code ENVELOPE at checkout, ENVELOPE, for free. Be like Al Pacino. Welcome to In the Envelope, a podcast from Backstage, the one-stop shop for actors and creators both above and below the line. I am your host, Vinny Mancuso, Backstage senior editor and professional entertainment obsessive. I'll be your guide through every corner of the creative industry with the help of some of your favorite stars. Here you'll find intimate, in-depth talks with today's most award-worthy names in film, television, and theater. Along the way, we'll get advice on living your best creative life, relatable stories of the highest highs and lowest lows, and maybe, just maybe, a rare peek in the envelope.
People get so much credit now for these big transformative roles where they play somebody 50 years older than they are and all the stuff that goes with it. It's, well, yeah, that is amazing, but there's nothing wrong with you. You're interesting enough. And if you want to bring yourself to this part early on in your career, then it's perfectly valid. Nobody knows you. Nobody knows your life story. And people want to find out about it.
Welcome to another new episode of In the Envelope, the Actors Podcast. I am your host, Backstage senior editor, Vinny Mancuso, and joining us today is the brilliant, the truly delightful, John Bradley. Now, I'd wager that the majority of you know John from the mildly popular series Game of Thrones. John, of course, played Samwell Tarly, the lovable man of the Night's Watch, for all 8 seasons of that show, which was, if you can believe it, his very first audition out of drama school. But John has parlayed his Game of Thrones role into a thriving career. He starred alongside Jennifer Lopez, of all people, in Marry Me. He's gone to space in the blockbuster Moonfall. Next up is Netflix's hopeful answer to Game of Thrones' three-body problem. Created by the very same Game of Thrones duo David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, along with Alexander Wu, and based on the landmark sci-fi novels by author Liu Cixin, Three-Body Problem is a sprawling series, jumping between locations, characters, and even time to tell the story of humanity's first contact with alien life. And John kind of plays the anti-Samwell Tarly here. He plays Jack Rooney, a cocky Oxford dropout who founded a multi-million dollar snack empire. It's a fascinating role and a fascinating point of what's truly been an incredible career so far. We dive into all of it, from that fateful first audition to finding his footing on the Game of Thrones set, to all the vital acting lessons and life lessons he's learned along the way. That's a great chat with a great actor. Let's get right into it. Here is John Bradley. John, how's it going? It's a pleasure to meet you.
Nice to meet you too, mate. Yeah, it's going okay. Thank you.
You're in New York right now? Where are you?
New York right now. I've been here for 2 days, 2 pretty hectic days, and I fly to Austin for South by Southwest straight after this, pretty much.
What are these days like? Where you just sort of like, what area code am I in? What does this do to a person when you're making the rounds?
It's actually really exciting because it feels like a long time since I did anything like this, since I've had a schedule like this, because, you know, probably since the last season of Game of Thrones went out in 2019, I've had things come out since then, but they were all in COVID, so I didn't get to go anywhere on press duties. I just did virtual junkets in hotel rooms in London. So it feels good, and it feels good to get out there with a new show to talk about and see the world again. And everything becomes so much easier when you've got a show that you're proud of and things that you want to talk about. And so it's no hardship. I feel very privileged to be allowed to do it.
Absolutely. Well, I just watched a couple episodes of Three Body Problem. It is very complex, very ambitious. I do want to say something that I want to get out there right now. I think it's wild that they gave your character a very prominent drum set in his house.
Yeah.
And you don't get to use it. I know that you're a very accomplished drummer. You're a very good drummer. I was hoping to see you get behind the drums.
I did shoot a scene that was Jack playing the drums. And they just decided because you shoot things on the day and you shoot them in isolation and they work on the day and everybody's happy, but you kind of forget sometimes how they fit into the grand scheme of the show. And I think they decided that sequence that we shot with the drums was just a little bit too light in tone for that stage of the story. So that, I mean, I hope that footage will emerge sometime, because I practiced pretty hard on that. And I've never played a drum set like that before.
Yeah, it was intense.
So it was a real thrill to do it. And I hope I can at least see the footage one day, because, yeah, and also just because David and Dan are like this, God love them, they painted it sky blue because that's the team colours of my rival football team. I support Manchester United, and so to support Man City to the extent where you get your huge drum kit painted in their team colours and have me play it, it felt a bit sick and twisted, but they've never been shy of that kind
it
of thing.
It is bittersweet, this incredible setup, and you're like, I don't even want to touch it. I don't want to go near it.
Yeah, but in a way, I know that he doesn't get to play it, but I think that says something about Jack that he doesn't play it.
Yeah.
That he spent all this money on this thing that looks cool and he thinks I'll probably get around to playing it one day. He spent so much more money than he really deserved to on a piece of equipment that you'll never even get behind. Yeah. I think that tells you a lot about him and his lifestyle and his attitude to his newfound wealth. So there's some merit in him not playing it as well.
Absolutely. So I'm very excited to talk about Three Body Problem, but I also want to, you know, this, because we are backstage, a lot of our listeners are, you know, aspiring actors, people who are, you know, early career actors. So we do like to talk about the whole journey to get there. So yeah. I do want to go a little bit back to the beginning. And I do mean, you know, the beginning. I'm curious what your initial pull towards acting was. Do you have an origin story of some sort of, like, you know, a project or a performance or anything where you saw it and you knew that's kind of what I want to do?
Yeah, very clearly. It was watching a lot of comedy when I was a kid. And we weren't a theatrical family. We've never known anyone that's been an actor before. We never went to the theater. We didn't really watch movies, and we didn't really watch a lot of drama on TV, really. It was mainly sitcoms. It was half-hour sitcoms. And there was something about that where I remember watching it and being made to howl with laughter at things like Fawlty Towers. And my parents are a bit older as well, so they showed me things like Sergeant Bilko and like some American shows. And I remember sat there watching it thinking, God, imagine being able to make somebody this happy. Imagine being able to find that connection with somebody who you'll never meet, who may be watching it 30 years after you're dead. And you can still make them happy. It felt like a very intimate relationship in a way. And it just felt like the best job in the world was to make people happy like that. And it's always that sort of discipline and that way of thinking has always been at the forefront of my mind when it comes to my approach to performances. Some actors make out that the audience is the last thing on their mind when they're performing. It's all about their internal process and what I get from it and how I feel about it. But I always know that I'm in service, and my job, my service is to try and make audiences entertained and make them happy. And yeah, that's always something that's at the cornerstone of everything that I do. Even in things like Game of Thrones, which was quite serious at times, I sort of accepted the responsibility of trying to find ways of lightening it and delivering lines in a way that tickled people's ears a little bit. And all of that stuff. I just having a very outward looking desire to make an audience happy. That's where it all started.
Did you ever have like an intro to performing itself, you know, before you know, formal training and before getting jobs, as a sort of person who was interested in acting, what was your first sort of taste of performance?
It was the usual, you know, the cliche of the school play,
mm-hmm.
where every kid gets a couple of sentences to say or a little scene to do, and everybody's involved and it's all very well balanced. I remember thinking when I had my turn once, oh, people have started listening now. Now that I must have only been about 6 or 7 years old. I remember thinking, oh, people weren't listening. Whoever they were, I apologize. But they weren't kind of listening a second ago. But now I've started doing my bit and they seem to have woke up a bit and they seem to be listening. And that felt like a really special fork in the road moment of, oh, I think I can actually do this. I think that I can hold people's attention. And it was really weird for somebody who was naturally at the time very shy and one-on-one, especially with strangers, wouldn't have particularly been that forthright and wouldn't have grabbed that dynamic by the scruff of the neck. To be in front of a group and have them all looking at me and listening to what I was saying, it just felt really comfortable and I can't really describe it. And then once I had it, I wanted it more and more. I didn't know how to get into acting or anything or stage school. So I had to become an altar server. It was Catholic background. And I became an altar server because it was the closest that I could get to being on stage in a costume.
Yeah.
And there was something about that dynamic. You're on a raised platform in front of a crowd of people.
There's an audience. Yeah.
There's an audience. And you know, it felt like a natural extension for it. But that was only because if I was from a slightly different class or slightly different social circle that my parents were in, I probably would have gone to like a stage school and done little plays. But because we didn't know about any of that, that was as close as I could get to having an audience.
It's interesting to hear a lot of that. But I think one of the most common things we hear on this show that I've always found so fascinating is that a lot of people who act professionally, they were shy kids and they yeah. kind of, you know, it was a way. And it seems counterintuitive to make your life performance and being in front of people. But it's something we hear all the time. And I find that so interesting.
Yeah, it feels a bit like, I mean, if you want to sort of think about it in slightly more negative terms, you do sense that in a lot of performers, there is a hole that needs filling in terms of their relationship with themselves. And I think if actors, if a lot of performers were better with people, they probably wouldn't feel the need to perform. And at that age, it's not as complex as, oh, I play a different character. I managed to hide behind this different character. It's just about finding a place that you feel comfortable. And I think it might be something to do with the fact it's all one-way traffic. That you talk and people will listen because of the very rigid sort of societal demands of that dynamic. I'm on the stage, and when I'm on the stage talking, you all stop talking and you listen. And I think that that's a more comfortable position for being for shy people than a two-way conversation. And it's a control thing. If you're on stage, if you feel you find it hard to control situations in real life with people who can answer back to you, if you're on stage and you know what you're doing, you're in control in that environment. And I think there's something to be said for that as well.
Yeah, it is that agreement, you know, like people, they have to listen to you know, they yeah. bought the ticket, they're in the audience. It's not quite a conversation. In a conversation, people can be distracted. But it is a conversation wherein the people have agreed to give you their attention and their care.
And just to bring it kind of full circle, I got to the point where I didn't want to do the school play anymore. For some reason, I just didn't want to do it. And everybody else had to audition. This is probably when I was a bit older. I was probably about 13. Everybody else had to audition. And they came. It was Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. And they said, there's this part that we want you to play in the school play. And I played really hard to get. Like, negotiations were quite ongoing. I was like, I don't want to do it. And they were like, oh, please do it. We really want you to do it. I was like, no, I don't want to do it. And in the end, they had to bribe me with drum lessons to do that part in the kind of school play. So yeah, it was it was, I really enjoyed it, but kind of being good at it and having a facility with it at that young age, that's when I was aware how rare it is to, especially in that environment, in that school, that your talent, such as it is at that age, is actually essential to the quality of the show. It felt like an epiphany moment.
Absolutely. You did eventually, you know, study at the Manchester School of Theatre, where you did a number of shows. You were in Twelfth Night as Toby Belch.
You
did Chekhov's Three Sisters, which is a mammoth show. I think it's like 3.5 hours. Is there any, you know, one of those shows you did during your sort of formal education period that was particularly informative for like the type of stuff you wanted to do, the type of actor you wanted to be? Does anything stand out to you as like, oh, this really struck a nerve?
It definitely would be Three Sisters out of those shows that you mentioned, because that was a completely different part for me, the part of Andre, the brother of the three sisters, who's a tragic character who's got a lot of promise, and then his life ebbs away from him, and he sinks into debt and sinks into alcoholism because of his very toxic marriage. I mean, the thing about that is, that's all very well and good, but to have to be expected to perform that properly at 21 years old, when you've just come out of school and just gone into drama school, you're never going to be any good at that part, really. Because even if you do manage to guess right, you're still only guessing. You've not experienced any of that loss and any of that sense of your life slipping away. So I'd love to have another go at that and really invest that with some of the life experiences I've had since then. I remember that when I was, it's unfair, but it's true. And it just goes to show you how wrong they can be sometimes, that I did that show. And then in my end, the final tutorial after it, my teacher said, "You're never going to play a vulnerable character in your life."
That was incorrect.
Bear in mind, this is March, and I started filming Game of Thrones in the July.
Yeah.
So it's like 6 months apart. They said, "You'll never play a vulnerable character as long as you keep having these barriers up and you don't really let the material or the character into your heart. You're too flippant and there's no vulnerability about you at all on stage." And I think that's sort of true. And I think I was able to find that in Game of Thrones because it was a completely different group of people. And I was able to reinvent myself, and I was able to actually be, it's counterintuitive, but I could be vulnerable in front of strangers in a way that I couldn't feel. I didn't feel like I'd be vulnerable with people that I'd been known for 3 years at that point. So I found it, but that was the state that I left drama school in, thinking that I had a big deficiency at the very heart of my acting that I managed to sort of get rid of. And then I've played vulnerable characters pretty much consistently ever since.
Do you think that was at all helpful to hear? Like it sounds like it's a very harsh critique, but did it set you down any sort of path, or was that something you really had to work out after you got Game of Thrones?
Well, one thing that it may be a useful piece of information, but it's probably not a useful piece of information to get 6 weeks before you finish the course.
yeah, exactly.
Because they didn't really provide any answers, and they didn't really let me know what. I mean, she said that the way around is, she said you have to love and then lose to get any sense of vulnerability. And the thing is, it wasn't necessarily about that. It was just about, because I did feel those emotions, and I did feel that frustration and that sense of yearning and isolation and frustration and all of those things. I just wasn't prepared to show it to that group of people, especially when you're doing plays where you're doing it in front of 30 people and you know everybody in the audience and your parents come to see it. That's a much more vulnerable thing to do than be on set in front of a lot of people you don't know for some reason, because you feel more judged by people you know than you do by strangers. So, yeah, I just naturally cast that off and just found that I was able to do it. And yeah, it's an interesting thing, drama training, where at the time when you're doing it, you believe everything they tell you because you don't know any better.
Yeah, they're the teachers. They must know what they're talking about.
They're the teacher, this thing. And then it's only when you leave, and as much as I had a great time there, as much as respect I have for them, you leave and sometimes you're a bit like, well, they can't know that much about it because they're not doing it.
Yeah.
They're just telling other people that they're not vulnerable with 6 weeks of the course to go. So, you know what I mean?
Good luck.
Totally. You're prescribed that process and you're told about Stanislavski and all that stuff and Brechtian theatre. And you sort of think that's how it has to be. And then you leave and you take some of that. But everybody's process is unique. And you know, you discover that for yourself, I think.
Absolutely. So as you sort of alluded to, it was not very long after somebody told you that you auditioned for Game of Thrones, and the rest is history. I'm very curious, looking back, what you remember, any specifics you remember, you know, from that audition, you know, before, during, after. Like, that is a life-changing moment. So what do you remember about the moment itself?
Well, firstly, I remember it being my first audition. I remember not thinking I was going to get it.
Mm-hmm.
Just assuming that I wasn't going to get it, but the best I could have hoped for is the casting director said to my new agent, "Oh no, he's not right for it. He's a bit inexperienced, but he did well, and you know it's mm-hmm. a good first audition." And then on the day, I had to come all the way down from Manchester to London, and the trains were really badly delayed, and I ended up being late for my recall for the second audition, and I was on the phone to my agent saying, I'm going to be there half an hour late. And they were saying, well, they may not be able to see you then in that case. And then I've spoken to David and Dan about it since. And they were like, the casting director said to them, this guy's coming down from Manchester. It's quite a long way. Do you mind if you just see him? And then they were like, yeah, okay, fine. So I came in late, really flustered, sweating, ran up through, it was a really hot day in kind of June, ran up three flights of stairs, just completely frazzled and all over the place. My head really wasn't in it. And now I look back, I think that may have been a slight advantage in terms of if I'd have got there early, pacing round and round the block, I would have been overthinking it and getting in my own head about it and probably getting too, I was more nervous about being late than I was about the actual scene. And I think that kind of distracted me from it and it let me be a bit freer with it. And yeah, it was just one of those things that after I did it, it felt good. And I remember Dan Weiss was there and Frank Dolger, our producer, was there. And then they looked at each other and smiled. And I didn't really know what that meant. I didn't know what happened at the end of an audition, but I could just sense something in the room where there was like something was affirmed at that moment. And then it took me a long time to actually get it. I kind of put it out of my mind, still didn't think I was going to get it. And then when I got it, it was a funny feeling, but yeah, it was. I just remember that day being very fraught, but at the end of the day, I think that maybe worked in my advantage slightly. I think
it's really funny to hear that. I don't want to endorse this as like a tactic, but you're not the first person to tell us a story about booking a role that they were running late to the audition. And
yeah,
we hear this a lot. It's sort of like they accepted that they were flustered. They accepted that they were going to take that into the room, and it kind of helped a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's just your instincts take over if you haven't got time to think yourself out of it. And believe me, I've got many more auditions from being on time.
Yeah, let's not say be late to all your auditions.
Than I got from being late, but I think then because I was so inexperienced and so nervous, it just distracted my mind slightly. Where I was so relieved that I got there. And so relieved that they were seeing me at all, I kind of let it all go and got in front of the camera on the day and just let my instincts take over. And I think there's something to be said for that.
So I can imagine, you know, the entire Game of Thrones experience was a bit of a whirlwind. You know, it's hard to track something like that. But in terms of just like yourself as an actor, were you able to track the difference between when you started Game of Thrones and when you ended Game of Thrones? You know, did you note any like key differences in who you were as an actor? You know, anything that experience taught you, especially that you know will not go away going forward?
I think I started off. This is a really weird journey to track. I don't think I was that nervous when I started off.
Interesting,
because I didn't. I didn't really know the rules. I didn't know too much about marks and camera sizes. So I just kind of took my theatrical training onto the set and just acted
mm-hmm.
in a way that felt pretty natural. It wasn't that much different apart from the environment and the stakes that you're aware of. It wasn't that much difference in my process to what it was when I was still at drama school 3 months ago. I got nervous as it went on.
That's interesting.
Something really weird happened where the expectation of doing well in a role, and then people start to like it, and you kind of got your own standards and your own reputation to live up to. And that was when I started to get nervous, not at the start. And I developed this really weird thing where I always played Sam with a slight stammer, because I just think it really fitted a character that never quite knew whether to speak or not, never knew whether to act or not. It was a bit like he'd have an idea and then he'd go like, I'll say it or no, I won't say it. Oh, no, I will speak or no, I can't speak. And what happened was when I was playing that character, after a while, the stammer would take over and I would just do it without realizing. I wasn't in control of it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And there'd be times where I'd have the first line in a take and the director would call action. And I'd be standing there just trying to get the words out for 30 seconds sometimes of silence. You've got no idea how long that feels like when there are actors who are waiting for you to speak and you're just sat there. It's almost as if you're locked into yourself and you're just thinking, why can't I speak? And that was never something that happened at the start. And I'm still not sure why it happened. I think it was something like a minor panic attack maybe happening, which made me unable to speak. And that happened for a couple of seasons and I never quite got out of it. I used to have to time my breaths to make sure that I breathed out before I started speaking. Because if I breathed in, I wouldn't be able to let the air out.
Yeah, that's...
It's really odd. And I remember just learning lines and looking at it and running into myself thinking, oh, there's a really bad one coming up. That's going to really trip me up on the day. And sometimes you just think, why can't I just be normal? Why can't I just learn lines and say them? I used to be able to do it back in 2010 when I didn't know what I was doing. Why has it got harder now? Never quite got to the bottom of why that was.
I'm sure every actor at some point has thought, why can't I just do it normal like everyone else? And so yeah. It's like, I don't think there is a baseline normal. Although I'm sure you've worked with people who've made it seem like they're just like, oh, you know, I have the baseline normal acting down.
Yeah, I think I've got to that place now. I think now it took me a long time to feel that I earned the right to be on set sometimes. And I was so early on, I was so deferential and respectful to people where I just stand and wait to be told what to do. And if they gave me a note, I'd just try and do it to the best of my ability. I didn't really have an opinion and I didn't feel entitled to an opinion necessarily. It's only now that I've been able to relax a bit more and feel more comfortable on a set and make it feel more of a collaboration. But it took me a long time, and now I think if I'm striving for anything in acting now, is to make it look easy. And it doesn't necessarily seem to be a style of acting that's particularly in fashion at the moment. People sort of like to see the effort, and actors like to talk about the extent that they went to and the efforts that they went to make it hard for themselves to get the most out of it. But if you just make it look easy, people think it is easy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, I've always liked it. It's a bit of a highfalutin way of saying it. And forgive me for a second. If my parents could hear me now, I don't know what they'd say. But the art is in the concealment of the art, I've always thought. And so now I think I'm relaxed enough that I can be relaxed on camera. And I think it's showing in more recent performances, I think.
I think that's, you know, it's the reason why I think a lot of comedic performances don't get the credit they deserve, because it like you said, you don't see the effort. It should look easy. You should just be like, oh, I assume that actor's really funny, so they did a funny performance. But, you know, that's still acting.
Yeah.
It just doesn't come off as acting. Yeah. As acting.
Yeah, I remember, because people, when they're watching it, they see one take of one scene. It tends to be directors and especially script supervisors on shows. They come. I've had them come up to me and at the end of a long day when we've shot a scene from every single angle, they're a bit like, you're the same every time. Every time you're just pausing for exactly the same amount of time. Your movements are the same. And he just looks really natural, but it's just because I've worked on it all, and I've kind of choreographed it up kind of myself, and I've timed all the words. But because people only get to see you do it once, and because it looks easy, people just think, oh, he's just come in and didn't quite know what he was doing. And that vagueness, I've always tried to, that is a sort of performance discipline in itself, I think.
Absolutely. So as you sort of, you know, with Game of Thrones being your first thing out of drama school, there's no denying that there's a lot around the show. You know, there's the expectations, the everything online, stuff like that. What are you taking away from that and how that, you know, figured into your performance as you head into another show that's, you know, it's a lot of the same creatives. It's based on a popular book. There's expectations. It's a big network. It's Netflix. What are you sort of taking away from the surrounding stuff as you head into a similar experience?
Well, you know, it goes back slightly to what I said a second ago about expectation. If there's no expectation of you, things are much easier. And, you know, if you've never done anything before, you can come out and give this debut performance, which everybody says is, you know, well, a lot of people say is very good, and you get really nice things said about you because of it. And then that just makes the second thing that you do feel more intimidating, because it's almost as if, well, anybody can fluke one good performance. How do you show that you're not just that? How do you show that you can apply that same process and those same techniques and bring them to a different character? And I think that's what it is. And I think that's the sort of hardship of being known for something, that unless you want your career to end there and not progress, you have to find a way of showing a different side of yourself. And that can be quite tricky sometimes. It's interesting with, you know, Game of Thrones and David and Dan's new show, Three Body Problem, that I'm in. They've written me this character because they realized while shooting Game of Thrones that I was nothing like Sam at all. And they got to know me well enough to think, I think Dan Weiss said it in an interview the other day, he said, John was diametrically opposed to the character that he was playing in Game of Thrones. And that's all very well and good until you realize that Sam was quite a nice character and really kind and loyal.
What are you suggesting?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But a weird thing's happened with me now where, because the first character I played was this guy that was down on confidence and nervy and didn't think very much of himself and shy, people think that I'm like that because that was the first time they saw me. So they might be forgiven now for thinking, oh, I am like that. And Jack Rooney, the new character I play in Three Body Problem, that's like a transformative acting performance as playing somebody confident. Whereas actual fact, I started playing a character and now the second character is more like me. Mm-hmm. So it feels a bit like I was typecast as something that's nothing like me at all. And I think that there's a sort of interesting way around to do it. You sort of think you play characters closer to you at the start and then branch out into other characters. I kind of did it in reverse.
It's so interesting to hear that, you know, people will think, they'll see you as a confident character and they're like, look at this feat of acting. But that's so interesting.
Yeah, I was talking to a young actor just yesterday about it, and that, you know, they were saying that the people around them are saying, don't try and get typecast. Avoid getting typecast straight away. And I remember thinking, well, you can't get typecast straight away. There's no way you can get typecast in your first performance. Your first performance is whatever it is. And don't worry about trying to transform yourself too much with your first character, because nobody knows who you are. Anything that they see of you is what they're receiving as the character. So don't be scared of putting the real you into things early on. It's only later when you get that expectation that you start to think, oh, how can I make this character different? But people get so much credit now for these big transformative roles where they play somebody 50 years older than they are and all the stuff that goes with it. It's, well, yeah, that is amazing, but there's nothing wrong with you. You're interesting enough. And if you want to bring yourself to this part early on in your career, then it's perfectly valid. Nobody knows you. Nobody knows your life story. And people want to find out about it. And I think if I'd have heard that, I'd have been really empowered when I was a young actor that I'm not so boring that I have to transform myself completely to be interesting. And I think that early on, you should just have whatever you have and use whatever you have. And as you get more experience, then that will change the way you see things. But just early on, just give yourself a break, I think.
So, like, you know, as you join on the three body problem and your next project, and I'm sure you do have some experience with this, but it is this grand thing, and it's very similar to Game of Thrones. And there's many characters. It jumps around, and it also jumps around in time and stuff like that. So when you're you know, doing character work, what's your sort of process or whatever for finding and mapping, you know, your character's place amongst the moving parts and the complexity? How do you sort of dig in when there's so much to fit into?
There was a lot from drama school I believed in at the time, and it's kind of drifted away as, you know, I've been working longer and stuff. But one thing I remember very distinctly is we were doing Three Sisters, we were rehearsing it, and we did this exercise where we had to think about what other characters in the play say to us when we're there, mm-hmm. and what they say about us when we've left. And I think that's a really interesting exercise in terms of finding your place in that group. If you take like somebody like Samwell Tarly, what people say to him when he's there, in terms of Jon Snow, maybe there's something about reassurance, and he puts a kind of kindly arm around his shoulders. And then when Sam's gone, Jon probably talks about him being a liability, or, you know, why do I have to look after this guy that's got all of these issues, and why am I suddenly a surrogate older brother to this guy? So I think in terms of establishing those relationships, it's what it's about. You can sort of think about the internal life of the character, but all the clues are there in terms of the way he interacts with everybody else around him. But every character is completely different. There's usually a piece of music that'll click me into it, and usually it's a lyrical thing that I connect with. And whenever I want to feel scared, and whenever I've had to play moments of isolation and moments of fear. Do you know that song "Oh Superman" by Laurie Anderson?
I'm not familiar, but we'll look it up immediately after this.
Look it up, and that's the song I listen to when I want to feel completely isolated and completely alone in the world. I'd listen to it a lot during Moonfall. I listened to it during some of the VR sequences in Three Body Problem. It's a song that takes all of the humanity away. And you're left completely alone, completely cold, and without any hope at all. It's a very powerful piece of music. And yet, for whatever emotion and whatever character I'm playing, I find a piece of music usually that clicks me into that headspace.
That's fascinating. Yeah, it's always interesting just to, you know, hear what works, you know, whether it's something physical, oral, you know, like it's whatever gets you to that headspace before they say action.
And whatever that is, nowadays, people seem to have become fascinated with the process. And you get actors talking at length about, these are the lengths that I went to do this. And whatever, you know, extremes they went to. But it's all about the result. And just because your process isn't the same as somebody else's, or you feel you're not working as hard as other people, if your results are the same as other people's results, then nobody cares. And I think sometimes if you get an actor talking about their process, it's because they want you to view the final product through the filter of how hard they worked.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in actual fact, if you just believe that the product and the result was enough to stand up on its own merit, then that's all you need. And I think that if you're an actor who thinks they don't have a process just because they're not method, and method is the most misused and least understood term probably in existence at the moment. If you don't feel you are that, don't feel that your results suffer because of it. If the results are there, the results are there, and just plow your own furrow and just be the actor that you want to be. And I think that's something that kind of needs saying at the moment, because there's a lot of talk about the harder you work and the sort of better the results. But sometimes you're just talented.
Yeah, and it kind of reminds me, your co-star Jess Hong said this very nice thing about you on Instagram, where she said that you're a master of delivering each line as if it was improvised, which I think really kind of goes back to what you're saying. It's a very naturalistic, but not in a very obvious way. It's just existing on camera.
Yeah, I think so. Not that I'm liking myself to Pablo Picasso. I think it's Pablo Picasso. But there's this amazing. I don't know what. Maybe I am doing, and forgive
Why
me.
Why not?
For this. But there was a story once that he was at some kind of convention meeting people, and he did this tiny little squiggle that took him 5 seconds and charged like $500 for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody said, "How can you charge $500 for that when it's took you 3 seconds?" He said, No. It's took me my whole life." And I love that story. And I think if there's one thing that's a part of my process, it's just listening to how people talk. I never stop listening to how people talk. And because I listen to how people talk, I'm aware of patterns of speech. And I'm aware that sometimes people do say things in a way that isn't obvious when you read the words on paper. And it's a bit like if you just listen to people and exist in the world, you will absorb all of these tiny little linguistic and little idiosyncrasies and little ticks when it comes to inflection, and you build up a store of them, and then you decide to give them to one of your characters one day. And that may not be the method, but it's certainly a method. And I was really happy when she said that about saying it as if it's improvised, because having spent a long time with me on set, she knows that it's not like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that I took that as a really, really nice compliment, and yeah, that's exactly, if I could get any praise at all, really, it'd be something along those lines.
Absolutely. And it does, it all really goes back to the ultimate goal of making it look easy, when in fact it's really not, and a lot of work went into it. But all the audience sees is, like you said, that one take where it looks easy.
Yeah, but that's watchability of actors is something that I've always responded to. The idea that somebody comes on and you just sort of settle in a bit. You settle in and you think, oh, well, I don't know what's going to happen in the next minute or so, but I know that they've tried hard to make me enjoy it as much as possible. And I'm just going to watch it and feel at ease and feel comfortable watching it. And I think that that's an underappreciated but quite valid priority to have.
Absolutely. So as we sort of wrap up here, I do want to ask, just about this one more thing. You posted not that long ago this sort of behind the scenes picture from Marry Me, and and you said something about, it's the moment right before action, and you're this really lovely caption about, what it's like to feel that tension and those nerves, but also that intense concentration, right before they say action. I'm curious what before action moment throughout your career sticks out in your head as, either the most, it felt the most monumental, or you felt the most concentration. What is a very prominent right before action moment for you in your career?
Oh, that's such a great question. There's a shot in, and it feels like a tiny thing, but I was so determined to get it right. There's a scene in, I think it's the end of season 2 of Game of Thrones, where Sam's out beyond the wall with Dolorous Ed and Gren, I think, and they know that 3 blasts on the horn signals White Walkers. And they hear 2 blasts and they think, which means Wildlings, which means we should probably go back. And then they hear a third, which means that there's White Walkers. And all the shot was the camera starts and just pulls in tight to my face. That was all it was. We didn't do the rest of the scene. It was just this special shot. And I knew that I wanted to get this thing of, without any change of expression, really, just the life just drains out of his face. And you can't really see what's changed, but there's something in the eyes has changed and the fear has really set in. And I think that when it comes to that kind of thing, you don't really feel necessarily in control of it. You're not as in control of your face as you are words and even the rest of your body. You're just hoping that these tiny little muscles in your face kick in to the right degree at the right split second that it comes off. And I remember just hoping that I could get that across, because that moment of that horn and that realization makes a threat that we've only ever heard about as being a myth. People now know that it's a real thing. So it's a huge moment in the show. And yeah, just that, it wasn't a big stunt. It wasn't a big speech. It was just me thinking, I hope my muscles in my eyes and my face do their job in the next 3 seconds. And sometimes just nailing little tiny, tiny things like that are what it's all about. And when you nail something like that, it feels, there's no feeling like it.
Absolutely. And that is a very memorable moment from that show.
Oh, good.
Absolutely. John, this was lovely. Thank you so much for being here. It's a pleasure to meet you. Pleasure to talk to you. And we can't wait for Three Body Problem and everything afterwards. Thank you so much.
Oh, I've really enjoyed it. Genuinely, it's been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks, as always, to our brilliant producer, Jamie Muffet, and to the whole team at Backstage, Samantha Sherlock, Mark Stinson, Caitlin Watkins, and of course, Casey Howe. Visit Backstage.com, and don't forget, you can subscribe to Backstage with code ENVELOPE at checkout for a free trial. 100% free, you simply cannot beat that. For more exclusive content, find us on Facebook and Twitter at In The Envelope, and subscribe, share, and leave a comment. Who should we interview next? Let us know. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time for another peek in the envelope.